joining us as we continue this series that we're doing for these summer months, which is having to do with the biblical roots of the American Republic. We're examining some of the various aspects of our governmental system and asking the question how our founding fathers were able to trace some of these underlying principles back to biblical sources. And of course, we know that much of what they were thinking about, although they were certainly informed by other sources as well, much of it was dominated by that kind of Reformed tradition that came out of the Protestant Reformation, filtered through the Scottish Presbyterians and the English Puritans into the colonial situation. And we're just looking at some of the ways in which those factors were important. We've looked at the initial principle that is connected with the fact that there is a God in heaven. Religious conviction at the time, of course, took that for granted. Political theory essentially has to proceed on one of two premises, either that there's God in heaven or there isn't, you know. If there is no God in heaven, then obviously power is simply a matter of who can wield the greatest and most coercive strength here on earth. But if there's a God in heaven, and if this government recognizes that, then that changes things considerably. If there's a God in heaven, that has immediate implications as to the nature of our human existence. And we looked at that last time, and now we want to take the next step and ask the question, just what's the implication with respect to civil government that we may craft as a result of this understanding that we have of ourselves? If I could just put this kind of graphically for you, it might be helpful. We start with the idea of God in heaven, and I'm going to use three terms to more or less describe the character of this deity. There's many terms that could be used, of course, but I think for our purposes, these may be three of the most helpful. One, that this is one God. We aren't polytheists. We don't look to multiple deities who are all competing with each other so that we wind up competing with each other at the same time, each deity claiming some kind of allegiance that may be in conflict with others. We say there's one God. He's an integrated God. He has one great reality, and that as we devote ourselves to that God, it's going to have a unifying impact, of course, on ourselves. Beyond that, this God is holy. That's probably the deepest descriptive term we can use of God in the Old and New Testaments. It's repeated. He's holy, holy, holy. I've treated that topic, by the way, in separate lectures at some detail if you want to hunt them down. But for now, we'll just take it for granted that this single deity is not distinguished simply by his might, although certainly that would be true. But beyond that, the fundamental moral quality at the very heart of this one is that he's holy. And this becomes the absolute standard by which we understand ideas of righteousness and justice and so on, these great principles that are supposed to have an impact on how we do government. And he is sovereign. He is the creator. He's the sustainer. He is the one who is absolutely in rule of that which he has created, that we are under his authority. And that, of course, gives rise to many significant implications with respect to how we understand ourselves. So we begin with God, and we notice now that God creates humanity. And just as we have these three terms that describe the God that has created us, we have, you might say, the reflection of those in the way that we understand ourselves. If God is one, then we have a fundamental premise upon which we can affirm human unity. And really that's true, at least from a biblical point of view. We understand that we did all originate from one human being. Adam was created. Eve was actually taken out of Adam. And so the two of them had a common root, and then they have children. And you might say now, thousands of years later, we're all cousins. You know, we all share the same family. We all have something in common. And that unity that we have as human beings then has immediate implications as to how we understand the way in which we should relate to each other. I grant you that the unity has not been the most conspicuous aspect of our lives together. If you don't read that, just read the morning newspaper. You know, you'll see plenty of evidence that we've tended to be quite violent toward each other, and certainly unity hasn't been our dominant theme. But from a biblical point of view, we would say that still undergirding as much of the divisiveness as we may see in the human situation, there remains this idea that we are united. We are one human race. and regardless of ethnicity or language or skin color or all of these various items that may distinguish us, there's still something more profound that unites us. Moreover, we have equality. This is the echo of God being holy. If God is holy and He's created us, therefore, He's created us in a sense to share together something of that holiness. The Bible speaks of what's called the image of God, the so-called Imago Dei. And while there's been a lot of conversation as to what exactly is intended by that term, I think it's safe to say that at the heart of it is the idea that God is holy, and thus we have something of that holiness in us. It's marred, it's fractured to be sure, but it never goes away. Even the person who is a criminal has a sense that they're a criminal, you know, that there is a sense of the moral idea written in our hearts that's really inescapable. The Apostle Paul says, "You are without excuse, O man, whoever you are that judges, because when I judge another, I condemn myself." The whole point of that is to say that we are incurable moralists. We're constantly evaluating each other based on moral standards. We understand, you know, dogs don't do that, elephants don't do that, orangutans don't do that. It's humans that go around evaluating life ethically. Well, where does that come from? You might say, we give evidence of the law written in our hearts, Paul tells us, Romans chapter 2, by the very way in which we behave and evaluate one another. So that idea that we have a kind of equality among ourselves is all rooted in the idea that there is a God in heaven who's holy, and He's made us in His image. And we come into this world equally in the image of God. Regardless of what your intelligence might be or other factors that may cause us to vary from one another, we are in that sense all created equal. We're also equally fallen. We are fractured. We have the problem of sin. So in all of these various ideas that we have connected to our humanity, we have something of a deep kind of equality that really unites us together. God is sovereign. That would be a way of saying God is ultimately the most free being we could imagine, but that gives rise to a sort of a related, more limited idea of liberty among ourselves. You might say that in some limited sense, we have sovereignty. We come into the world and we're free to make choices. We aren't constrained necessarily with respect to the things that we should do or not do. Within certain limits, we're free to do what we want. Now, there's limits to that. And the limits are precisely the point where what I want to do infringes on what you want to do. You know, there is a practical limit to the extent to which I can exercise my liberty. But within a rational domain, a rational province, I'm perfectly free to exercise my, you might say, private sovereignty in my life, pursuing the career I'm interested in, getting the education that I want, that sort of thing, without impairments from outside. These are natural qualities that devolve to the human race just because we're born human. And it's understood, certainly in American tradition, that these things are those things that are granted to us as inalienable rights that come to us from the deity. Well, as I'm living here in what philosophers have called the state of nature, I might decide that it's not very convenient for me to have to enforce all my own rules, and maybe it would be more appropriate to establish some kind of authority in my life that is going to protect these basic rights that I've been given. And so there is a tendency, of course, in human history to create authorities over us. The important thing to note, however, is that we create these authorities. The upper right of the picture you're looking at there on the screen says, "We the people." Well, that was expressly affirmed by our founding fathers. We the people do this. It's not just being pounded on us from outside, but because we have this unity, this equality, this liberty, we can get together and decide, okay, for purposes of convenience, we're going to create those who have enforcement powers. They're going to enforce rules that we ourselves endorse in order for our lives to be more sensible, more orderly, more predictable, more safe. And so we create these institutions, and they also reflect these things about us, which indeed reflect those things we've said about God. So our unity gives rise to a principle of election. We're all one human race, but we can choose. Now, the practical way to do that is by casting votes. And obviously, very few elections are going to be unanimous. But there is a sense in which we have a common will that's expressed by virtue of the fact that we all cast a ballot, and the ballot becomes a choice. And the choice becomes a matter of who is going to be in those offices we've created by which our lives are going to be ordered and governed and so on. So we have a right to choice. We have equality, and equality gives rise to the notion of accountability. You see, when I elect someone to a public office, I'm electing someone who is fundamentally my equal. Now, that person may be more competent than I am to handle the job that I'm assigning him to, but it doesn't mean that person has greater intrinsic worth. That person's a human being, I'm a human being. And in that sense, I have a perfect right to call that person to account if they're not handling the responsibilities that I've assigned to them in a way that meets the criteria that I had in mind when I chose them in the first place. So our equality translates into accountability on the part of those that are hired into the offices that I've created. And finally, we have liberty, which gives rise to legislation or law. We've mentioned before that law and liberty are united together. You can't have liberty without law. You can't have law without it creating a certain degree of liberty. Otherwise, the law simply becomes coercive force. The purpose of law is to protect us and to create an ordered situation in which we can live. Lawlessness, of course, is not freedom at all. Lawlessness is chaos. It puts us in ultimate risk. Law states the rules, and within the rules, then I'm free to engage in the behaviors that I prefer. So when we think about the government that's created based on a notion that we have, that we are here by God's design, then it gives us these particular principles. And that's what I'd like to look at briefly in the time we have right now. I'm calling this generically by the term the consent of the governed. We are governed, of course. We've decided to do that. We, the people, have created government, and we're going to consent to that government, but we're going to do it with certain stipulations, certain kind of qualifications. And so I'm calling this generally public choice and public responsibility, resting on three pillars: one, election; two, legislation; three, accountability. And those three, therefore, we want to talk about, and especially we want to ask, do we find those three principles set forth in the biblical narrative? Is there a justification for those that we can trace back to the Bible, as opposed to simply thinking we agendaed up out of our own creative imagination, you know, that idea? Well, first of all, election. Do we find the idea of election in the Bible? I'm calling election public choice of public servants. In itself, I think it probably is pretty obvious that that's a common sense way of viewing it. If we're going to have people who are in charge of enforcing law, of creating an ordered society, then those people should be the people that we have chosen. That's really the whole idea of consent of the governed, is we're consenting to those who we've placed in these positions of authority. That's virtually taken for granted. Any of the political philosophers of the day would have more or less nodded to this. It would be a pretty obvious idea. Montesquieu, for example, says, "Should we doubt of the people's natural ability to, in respect to the discernment of merit, we need only cast an eye on the continual series of surprising elections made by the Athenians and the Romans, which no one surely will attribute to hazard." The point he's making is, if you look back to Athenian democracy and the archons that they would elect as their rulers, or back to Rome and the consuls that they elected as their rulers, these were popular elections. They were obviously not popular in the sense that everybody voted. It was restricted to citizens. But nevertheless, it was still in that sense popular. And there are many occasions where the outcome of an election was not at all what the pollsters expected, you know, big surprises, which is simply the way of saying that people make up their own minds. They have an independence. And when they can cast a ballot and be unencumbered by outside forces, sometimes the decisions they make will surprise you. But all of this is predicated on the notion that people are capable of recognizing merit. I've never run for public office and I never will. I don't want the job, so I would consider it a real unhappy development if I wound up in some kind of elective office. I got better things to do from my point of view, but I want somebody there. I want somebody who's in that position. And the notion here is, even though I may not have the gifts of administration that qualify a person to be a political figure, I can recognize it when I see it. And that's really the notion here. People are able to recognize merit, even if they themselves may not possess those particular gifts that give rise to the merit that would be exercised by a person in authority. And that's the assumption that's at work here. Edmund Burke, the great English political theorist, said, "In their sentiments, the people are rarely mistaken. The people can make up their own minds, and usually they can recognize quality candidates when they see them." I'm going to attach a little bit of a qualification to that, because this does presuppose that the electorate has a certain degree of understanding. If people are absolutely ignoring what's going on, if they're ignoring political issues, if they're just completely uninterested in matters of who's leading them, then they can in fact make some really horrendous decisions. And certainly we've seen plenty of evidence of that in history. And so it needs to be qualified somewhat that we're assuming here people are paying attention, that they're taking a look at what's happening and they're evaluating who are the proper people to take positions of authority based on some idea of what would be involved in such a thing. You may recall Alexei Tocqueville, the French philosopher who toured America and wrote a book called Democracy in America. Made a trenchant observation. He said that, the American experiment is going to work just fine until people figure out that they can vote for themselves a share of the public largesse. De Tocqueville was concerned that if people finally figure out that they can use their ballot to get goodies from government, that might actually overcome their good sense to make good decisions. And I'm afraid that at least in times in our history, we've seen a fair amount of proof of the truth of what he said. The electorate should be well informed. The electorate should be responsible people who are paying attention and choosing people of demonstrated competence to the various rules and positions and authorities that are being assigned to them. Do we find that in the Bible? Well, we certainly do. I don't think I need to labor that point. The very fact that in the Old Testament we find repeated reference to elders, people that are recognized popularly as those who have the maturity, the experience, the wisdom to guide and give counsel to others, is more or less a practical expression of this that goes all the way through. More pointedly, you might think of the children of Israel as they were leaving Egypt. They wound up in the vicinity of the Mount Sinai, and you may recall Moses was approached by his father-in-law, Jethro. And Jethro came, and he was impressed, of course, with all the things that had happened, but he was appalled when he saw Moses there every day wearing himself out, judging all the little scrapes and scraps that took place among the people, and he gave this counsel to Moses. Jethro says, quote, "Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, rulers of ten." In other words, Jethro says, you need to spread the wealth here a little bit. You need to create an infrastructure of people under your authority who nevertheless can exercise that kind of responsibility. And that at least is a description of the kind of people that should be put in positions of authority. Now, pretty soon Moses figured out that it was not practical for him to run around the whole camp and figure out who were the people to install in those. And so he actually shifted the duty to the people. In the very first chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, Moses' last great sermon to the people of God before they entered into the promised land, Moses gave this instruction that they should choose wise, understanding, and knowledgeable men from among your tribes, and I will make them heads over you. Moses left it to the people to choose, to elect those that they wanted to be their rulers, and then Moses would reserve the right to install them. And this was probably a kind of ceremony that would take place. And that was really a practical device that was used throughout Israel's history, even under monarchy and so on. You still have the operation of that kind of electoral process. And so when we ask, does the Bible have some notion of popular election, we have to answer certainly affirmatively that that was very much a part of the way in which Moses had crafted the lives of people together as we see it in the Old Testament. What about participation in legislative acts? This would be the idea, do the people have a voice in the laws that they are enacting? Of course, in our system, we've given practical expression to that because we elect our lawmakers. The people that we send to Congress are there precisely to enact laws. And in some ways, the fact that we choose the people to enact the laws means that we're keeping some strings on those people, you know. We want them to enact laws that reflect our concerns, the issues that are important to us, and that's why we elect them. We elect them because we believe they're going to represent the kinds of concerns that we in fact have with respect to our lives. In the Old Testament, you find something of that as well. I think one of the most dramatic examples of it is when the Ten Commandments was given to God's people. You may recall in chapters 18, 19, and 20 of Exodus when the Ten Commandments and the collateral laws were given by God through Moses, that the people were not just pounded into submission. God didn't say to them, okay, now look here, I'm the biggest and most powerful being around, so you people obey me. He didn't do that. In fact, it was voluntary to the people. It's this extraordinary thing, and really somewhat different from what you'd find in other ancient civilizations. Moses actually put the question to the people, are you willing to submit to these laws? This is your choice. Are you going to, in fact, submit to the laws that have been given by God or not? It was a choice made. The people responded. This is Exodus chapter 19, verse 8. All the words that the Lord has said, we will do. You see, that's a choice. That's an exercise of volition. And it at least represents one rather dramatic example of how the people participate in the legislative process. And this, of course, is a theme that you'll see carried out throughout Israel's history. In fact, the political theorist Beecher, writing in the 19th century, volume 1, page 179, makes the following very interesting observation about Old Testament Israel. He said, this adoption by the Jewish nation of the laws which Moses brought from God was repeated at the death of Moses, and by a statute once in 7 years was to be repeated ever after by the assembled nation. This was the year of the sabbatical year that happened every 7 years. So that from generation to generation, once in 7 years, the tribes met in a great national convention and solemnly ratified the Constitution. They took what might be called the Freeman's Oath to observe that Constitution. It was a renewed commitment that the people made to observe the laws that had been given, and of course additional rules that may have come along from time to time, and this was a voluntary act in which the people would indeed engage in this kind of, you might say, covenantal commitment, signing their name, as it were, to the document and agreeing to a further extension of that relationship between God and His people. So the point is, as we see the notion of people participating in the making of the rules that are going to govern them, again, we see biblical warrant for that plainly enough. The final one is the notion of accountability. Do we see a notion in the Old Testament of people who are in elective office being accountable to the people that have put them there? And once again, it's not hard to demonstrate this. There's multiple examples of this. I think of Samuel, for example. You may recall in Samuel chapter 12, as Samuel is an old man, he's reaching the end of his tenure as the judge in ancient Israel, the last really of the judges in Israel at that time. He stands up in front of the assembled congregation and exposes himself to accountability. And it's a very interesting little speech that he gives there, if you want to check it later, but it reads as follows. Samuel said to all Israel, indeed, I have heeded your voice and all that you said to me, and I've made a king over you. Of course, Saul was the king that would be installed. And now here's the king walking before you. I am old and gray-headed, and look, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my childhood to this day. And then Samuel says, here I am. Witness against me before the Lord and before the anointed, his anointed. Whose ox have I taken whose donkey have I taken, or whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed, or from whose hand have I received any bribe with which to blind my eyes? I will restore it to you. Well, there's accountability, you see. Samuel isn't trying to crawl off into retirement and avoid any public examination of his life. He freely offers himself. I wish some of our politicians would do the same thing, to stand up and ask candid questions like that and take the responses that might come. But certainly in the Old Testament scheme, you do see that notion of accountability. The response given by the people in the same chapter, they said, "You have not cheated us or oppressed us, nor have you taken anything from any man's hand." Then he said to them, "The Lord is witness against you and is anointed as witness this day that you have not found anything in my hand." As Samuel is about to hand the baton, you might say, to Saul, he does a very interesting thing. He creates a writing, and the fundamental purpose of the writing is to spell out how it is that the king and the people are going to be related to each other. We would call this a constitutional monarchy. It's a monarchy in which the king is not absolute in his authority, but is in fact subject to law, as are the people. You may know in history there have been remarkable moments when constitutional monarchy was put in place. Louis XIV, of course, believed he was above the law. He said, "I am the state." He thought that he could do no wrong because precisely who he was. England had something like that, not quite as extreme, but certainly there were those who championed that. Thomas Hobbes famously argued for Leviathan, a kind of monarch who had absolute authority. But nevertheless, in English history, there was a great revolution. It's called the Glorious Revolution, 1688, brought in William and Mary. And that was probably the moment where, more dramatically than at any other in English history, a constitutional monarchy was put in place, which has survived to this day. And that was a great shift, you see. And that was exactly what was going on in ancient Israel. They were well ahead of the game when they put something like that in place. It represented a limitation on kingly power. Moses himself in Deuteronomy 17 had spelled out special rules that applied to the king. In fact, somebody said once that the king was the least free person in ancient Israel because he was not only bound to keep the rules that everybody else had to keep, but he had a special set of rules that applied just to him. But we find that reflected now in the behavior of Samuel as he's beginning to spell out to the people the terms of a constitutional monarchy. And so we have, for example, in 1 Samuel chapter 10, beginning at verse 23. So they ran and brought him from there. This is referring to Saul now. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. Saul, of course, at least at the beginning, looked like a very kingly character. Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen, that there is no one like him among all the people?" So the people shouted and said, "Long live the king." Then Samuel explained to the people the behavior of royalty and wrote it in a book and laid it up before the Lord. And Samuel sent all the people away, every man to his house. Here's a book, you see, that's laid up, and it's going to explain the behavior of the king, spelling not only the rights of the king, but the duties of the king, the rules that applied to the king. And that becomes, as we say, the foundation of a constitutional monarchy, not an absolute monarch who could do anything he wanted, but a constitutional monarch who was an administrator, had authority, but that authority had to be curtailed. And that was necessary to prevent any kind of abuse. You find similar kinds of things happening with other rulers in ancient Israel. When David had been ruling for a few years in Hebron, the 10 tribes from the north came to him. And actually, it was at this point that, again, a constitutional monarchy was enacted among them. This is in 2 Samuel chapter 5. "Therefore, all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel." They made a covenant. This is a constitution, and David was agreeing to do his role, and they were agreeing to do theirs. And thus, there was once again an idea of a law that was being put in place and solemnized before God. The son of Solomon, you may recall Rehoboam, taking over after the death of his father, was approached by the tribes of Israel as well, and they were asking him to give them a break. You know, life under Solomon had been in some ways wonderful, but it had been a pretty heavy burden, and they were saying, Rehoboam, lighten up a little bit, give us some breathing room here. So they said, your father made our yoke heavy, referring to Solomon. Now therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you. You see, we will serve you on the condition that you meet certain criteria, namely to lessen the burden. Rehoboam, of course, foolishly declined that counsel, and in so doing, of course, he created his first big headache as a ruler, because when he said he wouldn't lighten up, in fact, he was going to double down, then those 10 tribes said, well, okay, fine, we're going home. And the people turned around and walked away. It was voluntary. They weren't bound by absolute monarchy at all. They said, you know, we're out of here. Now, Rehoboam tried to get them back. You may recall that, but he was stopped. God stopped him through the voice of a prophet and said, no, Rehoboam, you don't have that right. The people have declined to recognize you as their king, and you now are going to have to go home and just live with the rule that's been left to you, and not go after and try to extort rule from these people who have declined to submit to your rule. When King Joash, the 8-year-old king, became king under the high priesthood of Jehoiada, we hear, this is in 2 Kings chapter 11, Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people, that they should be the Lord's people, and also between the king and the people. Again, you find that, and you can look at other places as well, where you see this as an undergirding principle that certainly reflects something besides a kind of absolutist approach to rule in ancient Israel. The idea that the people could hold the rulers accountable, that the people had a role in choosing their leaders, and that they had a role defining their laws, and all of that, of course, is part of what we find stipulated here. E.C. Wines writes, quote, all this was the action of the Republican spirit of the nation, a spirit inspired, cherished, and sanctioned by the Constitution. Who can doubt whether it was a Constitution intended for a free and self-governing community? And so when we think about the government that we the people created in our own American experiment, we see that we're on pretty safe ground when we ask, were those principles also at work in the biblical story? And in many ways, I think you would say that some of the framers were very much aware of that, and were aware that they were implementing undergirding principles that had been with them going clear back to the time of Moses. So the notion of choosing our civil servants, the notion of participating in the legislative process, right of holding accountable those who were elected officers, all of them, of course, lay at the root of our American experiment, and they also were very important, of course, in the original founding. And so I hope that helps as we think this through in the various ways in which the biblical roots can be found that lay behind the American Republic. Been great to have you along. Appreciate your attention. We'll be adding another of these pretty soon. But for now, I just want to thank you for joining us. Hope we'll see you again. And until that time, may God richly bless you.